How did I begin to catch on to this aspect of church history that I had never heard before? I mean, I'd read books on church history and heard lectures, never heard any professor talk about certain church fathers beginning to reinterpret the Great Commission that way. Well, I found out about it when I was invited to speak in a certain church in southern Texas, and I flew in on a Saturday. Sunday morning, the pastor came to pick me up. We were driving to his church. On his way to his church, we passed by another church, had a sign out by the highway. I read the name of that church, and I was surprised. It is called the No Great Commission Baptist Church. I asked the pastor, why do they call their church that? He said, Don, it's because their pastor began reading up on some of the early church fathers years ago and found out that they began to teach the Great Commission wasn't for the church, it was only for the apostles, it was finished by them, it's done. And so he said those church fathers were closer to the days and the thinking of the Lord and the apostles than we are. They must have known what they were talking about. I take their word for it. So he changed the name of the church and taught against the Great Commission. It was not exactly a pentalogic message there. It could be anti-pentalogic. And so that caused me to say, really? I'm going to start checking up on that. And found out about, you know, the church fathers emphasizing hermiting in caves, St. Anthony and others, and began to realize this was no minor thing. This was a major setback. Too many people accepted that teaching. And so years later, I was invited back to that same city in southern Texas to preach in a different church. And my wife, Carol, who's with me here, was with me on that trip. We looked in the yellow pages to see if the No Great Commission Baptist Church was listed. It's not there. Carol said, honey, it's out of commission. Now, I didn't ask my wife, Carol, to stand up. She was sitting right down here, and I pointed to her, but because she's not very tall, you may not have seen what a lovely woman she is, so turn around. There she is, way back there. My first wife was named Carol Joy. My present wife is Carol Joyce. That's some sort of an indication from the Lord, I think. And whenever I go out to teach about missions, I, if possible, like to lug a few suitcases, one or two or three suitcases filled with missions books. Because there's a limit to how much people can absorb and remember from verbally communicated information. You know, 5% of what people hear verbally, maybe 10% at the most, is remembered. The rest is gone. That is unacceptable. I found over the years, if I give people an opportunity to purchase resource materials that will reinforce what was taught and strengthen their memory of it, that helps tremendously. So that's why I carry suitcases full of books and helps to keep me in shape. When you fill a suitcase with books, the suitcase gets quite heavy. Books are blocks of wood sliced thinly. They still weigh as much from the wood from which they're derived. And you should see the expression on the faces of the sky caps at the airports. When I set down a suitcase on the concrete, a diminutive sky cap came along one time, tried to pick it up. It didn't budge off the concrete. With his hand still on the handle, he looked at me suspiciously. He said, sir, you have glued this suitcase to the sidewalk, and this is candid camera, right? I tipped him liberally for his good humor. So what's in the suitcases that I brought on this trip to New Zealand? Peace Child is out in the new edition with the new last chapter. It's back there on the table in the a few copies of a DVD, also called Peace Child, in which 1,000 men, women, and children of the Sawi tribe, former cannibals, reenact the main elements of the Peace Child story with great verve and vigor. They're great actors, and people have watched it and when a man is being killed, and of course no one was really being killed, but it was so realistic, someone in Australia who was in the television industry said, "Don Richardson, how could you stand there filming while they were killing that bloke?" I said, "No one was killed, that was a reenactment." "What, that's a reenactment?" "Oh, that is so realistic." So they really know how to demonstrate how they did what they did. And then I also researched and wrote Eternity in Their Hearts, which documents 27 case histories showing that God has sovereignly been seeding the cultures of mankind with Christ-foreshadowing elements in human cultures, things that serve as eye-openers for the redemptive message when finally a faithful messenger brings it. So we're bringing the God-prepared message to God-prepared people. But God-prepared messengers are necessary to bring the two together. That's what missions is. And after I'd written about all these case histories in Eternity in the Hearts, I began to find other authors are also picking up on the theme and writing about how breakthroughs can be accomplished around the world. And one of them is John Rush, who was introduced to you here and who introduced me. He had a very unexpected experience years ago when he was a director on a mercy ship sailing from one South Pacific island to another, distributing medicine and preaching the gospel, inviting people to come on board. And so he didn't know that on the other end of an island called Tana, living under the shadow of a smoking volcano, was a tribe of people who were very impressed by an American GI named John during the Second World War. Maybe he was a medic who treated people with medicine, but they were so impressed with him. And he said to them, "I like you, and after the war, I'm going to come back and bring you a message about God." So the people said, "We'll be waiting for you, John." And they didn't know his last name, but they called him John from America, from spelled F-R-U-M. And so they were waiting for John from America to bring a message from God. And after the war, he didn't come back. So they said, "It must be we're not living right. And that's why he's not returned to us. So let's improve ourselves." And they'd seen John and his fellow GIs marching, singing military drill songs with rifles, with bayonets over their shoulders. So they made wooden facsimiles of rifles with bamboo bayonets, marched singing something like military drill songs as if they were hymns. It was like they were forming a religion around the expectation of John from America. Pastors from the little town on the other end of the island would come and try to preach to them. They said, "No, no, no, you're not John from America. We can't listen to you. We're waiting for him." So here was John Rush from America. The pastors came on board that mercy ship and saw him and said, "Guess what, John? God has brought you to Tana to evangelize the John from people at the other end of this island." "No," he said, "I don't think so. I'm here to dispense some medicine and sail on." They said, "That's what you think, but we know better." They practically kidnapped him off the ship, put him in a four-wheel drive vehicle, drove him to the other end of the island and introduced him to the John from people. And they all gathered around staring at him. And something began to happen that just absolutely swept John Rush right off his feet. God used him in an incredible way, and he tells the story in a book that he has co-authored with Abby Anderson called The Man with the Bird on His Head, an engaging story. I sell hundreds of copies of it, in connection with my own books in ministry, especially in the U.S. and Canada, but I have some copies of it here for you. And the next thing was the challenge that God laid upon my heart to study Islam. I gained some experience in cultural analysis and the ability to ask questions, to conduct a culture probe. But what about Islam? And I sensed that burden from the Lord and applied myself to study the Quran in depth and to read books that other investigators of Islam have written, some back in the late 1800s, some in the 1900s, and did my own in-depth study and wrote Secrets of the Quran. And this is the basis for my comments about Islam during this next hour. And as you know, copies of this are available for you as well. There are believed to be approximately 1.7 billion people on the earth today who call themselves Christians, including Catholics and Protestants, and about 1.3 possibly soon to be 1.4 billion people who adhere to the religion of Islam. And we live in a day when Islam is no longer just huddling out there in the far side of the world, away from Western civilization. Islam is on the move. It was on the move when it first burst out of the Arabian Peninsula in the very late 600s and overran two-thirds of what was then the Christian world, using the sword, the scimitar, to impose Islam upon almost all of North Africa, Syria, and Asia Minor, where the Apostle Paul and Barnabas planted churches. It invaded to the north of the Mediterranean Sea, took control of Spain and Portugal, invaded France, and got to Tours, which is only about 300 kilometers south of the south coast of England. They were intent on conquering all of Christian Europe and subjecting it to Islamic rule. But Charles Martel stopped the Islamic advance at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD. Muhammad died in 632 AD. So within just 100 years of Muhammad's death, Muslim armies had achieved a very large degree of conquest, so Islam was certainly on the move. They were driven out of France after they were defeated by Charles Martel and his army of Frankish warriors. Then they later launched another invasion, an attempt to conquer Christian Europe, coming up from through the Bosphorus, the Balkan states, and this time their armies got almost to Vienna in Austria. They were defeated by the Habsburgs with help from an army of Polish people sent to help. And they were defeated on September 11th, 1683. And there are those who think that Osama bin Laden may have chosen the date September 11th as a way of saying, we're back, we're on the move again, the war continues. So we live in a day when Islam is rejuvenated with ambition. And the seeds of that very strong ambition come largely from the way a Muslim cleric named Wahhab, spelled W-A-H-H-A-B, taught about the Quran back in the 1700s. Seeing a civilization that he regarded as Christian, European civilization, spreading its influence all around the Islamic world, gaining control of much of sub-Saharan Black Africa, advancing over into North and South America, opening outposts in other nations. He became very concerned. He said, Islam is supposed to be dominant. How can it be that this heresy called Christianity is outpacing the true religion? And in his analysis, he decided that the reason Islam was losing ground and falling back into second place behind the Christian world was because Muslims had given up on jihad. He said, when we were focused upon jihad as the primary duty of Muslims, look what we accomplished. Then we began to substitute honoring the five pillars instead of jihad. The five pillars of Islam, jihad is not one of them. Some people call it an unofficial sixth pillar. But the five pillars are saying the Shahada, acknowledging there's only one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. To convert to Islam, someone has to say that three times in the presence of two Muslim mullahs. And the obligation of praying five times a day toward Mecca and paying the alms and the pilgrimage, if possible, etc. But Wahab said, honoring the five pillars is okay, but it's not enough. And it is not acceptable to Allah. Allah requires us to engage in jihad. And he knew he had basis in the Quran to say that. Because the Quran has 109 verses among 6,200 that call for Muslims to be prepared to engage in violence, aggression, military aggression against infidels with a promise of eternal reward from Allah if they are willing to do so, and threats against them if they refuse to do so. At the back of the book, Secrets of the Quran, I have an appendix listing all 109 war verses, also known as jihad verses. So Wahab knew about those verses. And those verses are pretty drastic. In chapter 8, you'll find several of them, including the command, cut off their heads. Beheading infidels is authorized by Muhammad in chapter 8. And torture is advocated there also. Cut off their fingertips. Ambush them. All sorts of acts of violence are prescribed by Muhammad in 109 verses out of 6,200. That means, on the average, one out of 55 verses in the Quran is a war verse. Now, Muslims will counter, if we mention that statistic, by saying, but there are peace verses in the Quran, and those are what we go by. So don't worry about the war verses. That's only if you attack us. But if you don't attack us, hey, the peace verses are what prevail. And they're right. There are, guess how many? 6 peace verses in the Quran. And let me quote 2 or 3 of them for you. One is the verse where Muhammad recited. He didn't write because he was illiterate, but he recited, there is no compulsion in religion. So that sounds reassuring. Seems to promise that if you're not a Muslim, choose not to be a Muslim, you're not going to be forced to convert. It also seems to indicate if you're a Muslim and decide you don't want to be one anymore, you're free to leave without being charged with apostasy as a capital crime. That's a peace verse. Another peace verse is one that President George W. Bush quoted to the American public on television on Veterans Day 3 years ago. Apparently, the word had gotten back to him that whereas he'd been saying Islam was a peaceful religion, it's a great religion that's been hijacked by a few radicals, feedback was saying that a lot of American people are doubting that you're really giving an accurate description of Islam when you say that. So he apparently felt the need to reinforce his claim. He has lots of Saudi friends in Washington, D.C. He may have gone to one of them, said, please give me a verse from the Quran that proves that Islam is a peaceful religion. So someone did give him a peace verse, and I quote it. He who slays one man, it's as if he slew all of mankind. He who spares one human life, it's as if he spared all of mankind. So this was quoted to the American public, the implication being Muhammad was so against bloodshed that he warned that strongly against slaying even one person, and so in favor of sparing human life that he that strongly encouraged mercy to enemies. Well, there's a problem. And Muslim theologians are teaching in Muslim schools and teaching in Muslim mosques around the world. Yes, there are the peace verses, but they're all given by God to Muhammad when Muhammad was still living in Mecca. They're exclusively from the Mecca period, the early life of the one they call a prophet. And here's the historical background to that. When Muhammad was beginning to assert that he was a prophet in the city of Mecca, his hometown, he was born there 570 AD, and some years later, he conceived the idea of proclaiming himself as a prophet. And so he was saying to pagan people in the city of Mecca, and by the way, I found no evidence there was a church in Mecca. Could there have been? Surely there could have been a church there if the church had just, you know, just a few hundred kilometers north, not given up on the all peoples on earth being blessed. And I don't even find any evidence there was a synagogue of Jews in Mecca. So it was a pagan city. It was the idol worship center for many Arabian tribes of the what is now called Saudi Arabia. But he was saying to the pagans in that city, the God, the same God who sent Moses to the Jews and Jesus to the Christians, has commissioned me to you. I am a prophet from him for you. And you are idol worshippers. You must stop worshipping idols. You must renounce idolatry and submit to Allah, using the Arabic name for God. And there are some who claim that the name Allah is not a proper name for God, not what might be called an AKA for Elohim. You may have heard me talk about AKAs for Elohim in another place. And perhaps you are wondering, does Don Richardson regard Allah as a valid name for God in the Arabic language? There's a Christian author named Dr. Robert Morey, who's written two or three books about Islam. First one's called The Islamic Invasion. And in his latest book, he declares that Allah cannot be used as a name for God because Allah, in a slightly different form, was the name of a moon god worshipped in Mecca. You've heard that? And as evidence for that view, he says, what is the primary symbol for Islam on the flags of many Muslim nations? The crescent moon. And so he's saying to use the name of a moon god as a name for the creator of the heavens and the earth is syncretism. And we must not do it. Not only must we say to Muslims, Muhammad was not a prophet, we must also say the Quran is not a revelation from God. We must also say Allah isn't even God. Well, that's what he is emphasizing. That's what a lot of Christians are picking up and beginning to teach. And because the book that he wrote declaring that has been translated into Indonesian and into other languages used where there are Christians living among Muslims, here's what's happening. There are like somewhere between 30 and 40 million Christians in Indonesia, which is also the world's most populous Muslim nation. And because some Christians in Indonesia are reading Dr. Robert Morey's book, they are coming to the conclusion the Dutch translated the Bible for us, and they used Allah all the way through. And we can't use that Bible anymore. We have to reject the Bible. We need a new Bible that uses the Indonesian word Tuhan, which means Lord. We cannot ever call Jesus Anak Allah, the Son of Allah, or Anak Domba Allah, the Lamb of God. Other Christians are saying, that's an Arabic word that was used for God before Islam began. How can you tell us that's the name of a moon god? We don't believe that. So there's a great danger of a schism happening in the midst of the Indonesian church. And Indonesian Christians, I'm so glad to tell you, have been, I would guess, at least 1,000 times more effective in winning Muslims to Christ than any other group of Christians since Islam began 1,400 years ago. But with this kind of a split threatening, that may be coming to an end. Well, it is true, linguistically, historically true, that Arabic-speaking Christians were using the name Allah for God before Islam began. There is no way that they would have taken the name of a moon god. And if Muhammad tried to redefine the nature of a moon god in Mecca, where everybody knew about the moon god, tried to say that's actually the god that Jews and Christians worship, people in Mecca would have laughed him out of town instead of getting irate with him. So I really think that Dr. Robert Morey has made a mistake in overlooking the historical evidence that if you're talking to a Muslim who speaks English, there's no problem, just say God. They'll accept that. So it isn't a problem for us in nations like New Zealand. But you do have to make a decision if you're going to go and mingle with and minister among Muslims on their turf. You have to decide whether you can use that name or you feel conscience-bound not to use it. If you're talking with Muslims in Iran, no problem also, because they have a Farsi name for God, Khoda. And that is linguistically related to our English word God through the Indo-European language system. So you can say Khoda and they'll know who you mean. No problem there. But elsewhere where Arabic is the language of the people, it is necessary to use the name Allah it, or they won't know who you're talking about. Well, what about the crescent moon? Muslims declare that the crescent moon is a symbol of the beginning of the holy month Ramadan. They define the beginning of that month not by looking at a calendar. They watch the sky at the evening, and the first appearance of a crescent moon lets them know that's when the holy month of Ramadan begins, when they must fast during daylight hours and make up for it after dark. And if that is not the only significance of the crescent moon as a symbol in the Islamic religion, it may also be a euphemism for jihad. What was the shape of the sword that the Islamic armies used? The crescent-shaped sword. But there is a problem, however. I said yesterday evening, and some of you may have been there, that when the apostles used the Greek word theos as an aka for Elohim, Elohim in Hebrew, theos in Greek, deus in Latin, they knew that when the Greeks used the word theos in the special sense of the theos, the uncreated creator, a god greater than Zeus, who was the offspring of other gods, Cronus and Rhea, when they used the name theos, not all of the attributes that scripture associates with Elohim were in the minds of the Greeks when they used that name. But they reasoned the basic concept is valid. Missing attributes can be filled in by patient teaching over time. And that was accomplished. So also with the name Allah. But it's even more difficult because in the use of Allah, it isn't just that some attributes that Scripture associates with Elohim are missing, but some bad attributes have been infused. Because Muhammad represented Allah as a kind of war god, a god who encourages hatred of mankind, not a god who God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That just isn't there. So I urge that if you're going to work among Muslims in an Arabic-speaking country, feel free to use the name Allah, but just remember you have an obligation by your example, by your teaching, to negate some of the negative attributes that Muhammad added to the concept and replace those negative attributes with the true attributes of our God. And if you disagree, fine. But you know what? Muslims in Malaysia are seeing that Christians in Indonesia have led several million Muslims out of Islam into Christian faith since 1965. And they're terrified lest that hemorrhage of Muslims forsaking Islam and becoming Christians is going to spread north into Malaysia. So to try to counteract, to keep that from happening, guess what they're pressuring the government of Malaysia to do? Make it illegal for Christians to utter the name Allah. They want to seal off our lips. So if you're in Malaysia and a Muslim hears you say Allah or four other words that are part of the Malaysian language, Rasul, Apostle, Keselamatan, Salvation, and Rahmat, which means mercy, and Allah. So they want to make it so difficult for Christians in Malaysia to bear witness to Muslims just by making it illegal. You can spend a night in jail or pay a fine if a policeman hears you as a Christian or any Malaysian citizen. Even though these are words that are part of the Malaysian language, they're telling people you can't use these words in your language. Oh, and so these are some things that are in the background. Well, when Muhammad was preaching against idolatry and urging submission to Allah in the city of Mecca, there were pagans who believed him. Most of them were on the lower levels of the social strata, it appears. But some of the more elite pagan people in the city of Mecca contradicted him, opposed him, because they were committed to the worship of the idols. They were enriched by other people coming from a distance. And there was some commercial involvement there that they profited from. So they countered the preaching of Muhammad by saying to him and to the other pagans, don't believe this man. He is saying he's a prophet sent to us by the same God who sent Moses to the Jews and Jesus to the Christians. How do we know that's true? The answer is we don't know. If that is true, the Jews will be able to affirm it. So, Mr. Muhammad, if you want us to believe you, you have got to go up to the city of Medina where there's a significant learned Jewish community. Make your claim to them. And if the Jews acknowledge you as the prophet you are claiming to be, that will carry weight with us. But we're not going to believe you're a prophet just because you say so. We need a second opinion. So with the passage of time, Muhammad felt an increasing urgency to go from Mecca up to Medina and make his claim to the Jews there. Muslims will say he only left Mecca and went to Medina because persecution was heating up. Well, the persecution was heating up, but not against him personally. I'm convinced by my study he was socially well-connected in the city of Mecca. It was his followers who were more in danger of violence from the idol worshippers than he was. But he had two reasons for going: for the protection of his followers from possible violence in Mecca, and his desire to win an intellectual affirmation from the Jews in Medina, because if they would confirm his claim, the sky's the limit, and his movement would gain momentum rapidly. On the way from Mecca to Medina, a distance of nearly 300 kilometers, he said to his followers, 70 or so who left Mecca in company with him, when we get to Medina, we're all going to prostrate ourselves on the ground 3 times a day and pray toward Jerusalem. That was to impress the Jews and help to win their affirmation for his basic claim. Well, he arrived in the city of Medina, and he and his followers prayed 3 times a day toward Jerusalem, and people were watching this. And the Jews had heard reports about him. They knew there was a man down in Mecca who was making some pretty great claims. And here he was. They were curious about him. So they came to check him out. And he said to them, I desire, Allah desires, that you will tell the pagan Arabs that I am a prophet. Now guess what he was saying to the Jews. The same God who sent Moses to you and Jesus to the Christians is sending me to the pagan Arabs. Which part of that did he not know the Jews would not accept? That's an indication of a level of naivete that he was under. So when he said that to the Jews, some of the Jews reacted, saying, don't talk to us about Jesus, we crucified him. And that shocked him, because Muhammad didn't know about the crucifixion. He didn't realize. He was so lacking in knowledge. He was just finding out there was a lot more to be learned. But right in front of his followers, some of the Jews said that, and all his followers were looking at him saying, what? The Jews crucified? The Jews don't acknowledge Jesus as a prophet? What's going on here? Muhammad, didn't you know that? You didn't tell us that. What's happening here? So it was a moment of crisis that he was taken by surprise, and his followers were looking at him, beginning to wonder, maybe he's not so telling the truth after all. So he had to say something, and he blurted out, and it's written in the Quran, it's included, because there were scribes. He had made sure there were scribes that would be near him. Whenever he said anything significant, they would write it down in Arabic, and these things would later be collected to become part of the Quran. He blurted out to try to save face for his total unawareness of the crucifixion of Jesus, you thought you crucified him. It was made so to appear to you. That's in chapter 4 of the Quran. So he said, it was mistaken identity. You thought you crucified him, but Allah had already lifted up into heaven, so you couldn't crucify him, and you crucified someone else in his place and thought it was him. And the Christians were misled by that too. So this became a doctrine in Islam. Jesus didn't die. All right. Now that is compounded by the fact that in Muhammad's downloadings, if I may use a computer term, from Old Testament scripture, into the Quran. He tells the story of Israel's exodus. He knew about the exodus, and he must have made that one of his favorite pulpit pieces, because Muhammad narrates the story of Israel's exodus coming out of Egypt 27 times in the first 89 chapters of the Quran. There's 114 chapters in the Quran, beginning with the longest chapter up front, chapter 2, 286 verses, and with a few exceptions, each successive chapter gets progressively shorter till the last one is only about 8 verses. Well, by the time you get to chapter 89, there isn't enough space to tell a long story, so I guess that's why it isn't repeated after chapter. So that's the same story once in every 3.3 chapters. Now, what is the most important event in the Exodus story? What is the one event which, if it hadn't happened, there wouldn't have been an Exodus at all? The Passover sacrifice. Yes. Well, guess what? I almost missed it. Didn't find anybody else has pointed this out. But I was about, and here's how you can check this out. You can go on google.com and enter a search engine like google.com and just type in the word Quran. Hit enter and you will immediately have at least a dozen websites that give you the entire text of the Quran right in your computer screen. Just type in the name Moses, hit enter, and you will see Muhammad tells the Exodus story that many times. So I was reviewing this, counting, because I thought, something is that repetitious. It needs to be documented. And I almost finished that, but it was like God was saying to me, Don, don't wait, wait, you're not finished yet. There's something else you haven't noticed. What is it? Ah, I checked again and found in 27 tellings of the Exodus story, there's not one mention of the Passover sacrifice. So it's downloaded, but in the process, it's virused. So, the denial of the crucifixion and not even an acknowledgement of the atonement in the Passover sacrifice. So, you know that I've written in Peace Child, Eternity in the Hearts about these redemptive analogies, cultural compasses. Of course, in my study, I was looking into the Quran to see if there's anything there, or in the Hadith, the second most sacred body of Muslim literature, whereas the Quran itself is only two-thirds the length of our New Testament. The Hadith, the traditions, is about 7,500 pages of sayings of Muhammad and deeds he did that didn't make it into the Quran, but which were recorded after his death by his contemporaries. Well, actually, they didn't record them. His contemporaries were mostly illiterate, but they recited them verbally for about 200 years, and then finally they were all written down and constituted the Hadith. So as I was going through this, I was finding that there is one thing. When Abraham was commanded by God to take his son and offer him as a sacrifice, the Quran says Abraham took both Isaac and Ishmael with him. And they came to the appointed place. And then it says Abraham placed his son on that altar. It doesn't say which one. But Muslims assume it was Ishmael, their ancestor, even though the Quran doesn't actually specify that it was Ishmael. So then it says in the Quran that Allah provided a ransom for him, and the ram took Abraham's son's place. So, I found out many missionaries have used that as a redemptive analogy, saying just as the ram took Abraham's son's place, without saying which one, so also God has provided Jesus to be the ransom for you and me. The ram was a foreshadowing of Jesus dying on the cross to atone for the sin of the world. Put your trust in him and be at peace with God. And many Muslims have been led to faith in Jesus by the use of that. But there is a problem. That's when you're talking with a Muslim who doesn't know about the denial of the crucifixion in chapter 4 of the Quran. And probably a majority of them don't know about it, because a majority of Muslims do not read the Quran. You ask the average Muslim, have you read the Quran? The most common answer you'll get is, no, I haven't read it, but we all know what's in it. So they think. But if you're talking with a Muslim who has been attending meetings and heard teaching by a mullah, who is really covering issues like that, he will react negatively. No, 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 you can't say that because Jesus wasn't crucified. That was only for Abraham's son, not, it doesn't portend to Jesus, because Jesus wasn't crucified. This is the main thing that makes Muslims the most difficult people for us to win, is the fact that Muhammad denied the crucifixion. He denied it just because of something the Jews said, and he blurted something out on the spot impulsively, and it's become a doctrine. Well, there are other repetitions in the Quran. Muhammad tells the story of Moses and in the Exodus, as I said, but he also tells the story of Noah and the flood 27 times in the first 87 chapters. And the story of Abraham is told again and again. The limited number of Old Testament stories he knew a little bit about, he keeps telling and telling and telling and telling. And there are also narratives of Arab culture heroes that you and I have never heard of. And he tells those stories again and again. So I did a check and found that if all the stories that Muhammad repeats multiple times in the Quran were each told just once, that alone would reduce the length of the Quran by 45%. So 45% of the Quran is just telling you stories that are already in the other 55%. But also there are hell threats. Muhammad knew about New Testament teaching of hell. Not that he ever read the New Testament. He was illiterate, 4 verses in the Quran. So he's acknowledging himself as an unlettered prophet. But he believed that things were being recited to him by the angel Gabriel. At least he said he believed it. And he was repeating whatever he heard Gabriel say so that it could be written down. And the Quran means recitation. So it's recitations coming from God. And so he knew about the biblical teaching of that there's a judgment awaiting mankind. And hell is taught in the New Testament. Well, the New Testament, I did a survey and found, warns about God's judgment once out of every 120 verses. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, for example, it is for man once to die, and after death, the judgment. But Muhammad threatens people with hellfire in 1 verse out of 8 all the way through the Quran. So he apparently saw the potential to take a valid biblical doctrine from the New Testament and amplify it vastly out of proportion to other teachings in order to use that as a means of intimidating enemies and cowing his followers into ever more complete submission to him for fear of hell. 1 out of 8 verses. So it's just all the way through. That's the average recurrence. We need to understand that Muslims have a deep dread of hell because of how strongly it is emphasized in the Quran and in the Hadith. And in the Hadith, there are also things about hell. For example, in the Hadith, Muhammad claimed that Allah granted him a vision of hell in which he looked out and saw millions of people and evil spirits called jinns suffering in the flame. And as he looked over that mass of suffering beings, he said, oh, there's more women down there than men. So he was curious. He asked Allah, please tell me, why are there more women suffering in hell than men? And the answer Allah gave to Muhammad, according to him in the Hadith, is because women are so unappreciative of all the wonderful things their husbands do for them. That's a quote. So, that is something he no doubt said to give Muslim men something they could use as a club to browbeat their wives into total submission. There's another verse in the Quran that authorizes Muslim men to beat their wives if they're especially stubborn. And there are so many other things in the Quran. There's a set of laws based on the Quran and the Hadith called Sharia law. In Sharia law, if a Muslim woman claims she's been raped by a Muslim man, She cannot bring a charge against him in a court of Sharia law unless she can find four other Muslim men of good repute who will testify that they were eyewitnesses of a crime of rape. What chance does she have? And if they were eyewitnesses of the crime and didn't intervene to help her, maybe they were on the side of the criminal. Now, if there were things like this in the New Testament, I think the media would make sure the whole world knew about them. Well, Muhammad has things like this. There are things in the Quran too I haven't yet told you about. Absolutely shocking things. And the media is just blasé and indifferent, quick to criticize Christianity, slow to even think about bearing down with scrutiny upon Islam. Oh, here are some of the things. And I'm amazed that other researchers don't make mention of some of these shocking things. In the Quran, I found a long verse, and often when you find a verse that's really long, get suspicious. It's because there's something at the end of the verse that is shocking, and they hope you won't notice it, so they put a lot of boring stuff in the front, hoping you'll start reading the verse and say, oh, I've already read stuff like this before, you'll bypass skim. And that's what happens, you know, because the Quran is so repetitious, constantly telling you the same thing as you've already been told, your brain starts complaining, what have I done to you that you're punishing me with this? You begin reading and boredom sets in, and reading gives way to browsing, and if you keep going, browsing gives way to skimming. And I think that's why some learned scholars have missed things that were really important that should be brought to public attention, because it's right there. It's in print. It's part of their holy lore. But I noticed I was starting to skim. And I said, Lord, I cannot be a skimmer. I've got to be a reader. How can I stay focused when the boredom is so intense? And I believe the Lord whispered to me the solution. You notice the repetitions? Oh, yes. Count them. Just count the repetitions. See how many more occurrences of this, that, and the other thing you can find. That'll keep you focused. And it worked. I stayed focused. And I didn't miss things, I believe. I found a lot of things that had been overlooked by others need to be known. So I endured the boredom so you won't have to unless you want to. And here is something I found. Chapter 24, verse 33. In the middle, Muhammad says this. Do not compel your female slaves to be prostitutes to increase your wealth. Does that sound like a moralistic statement? All through the Quran, slavery is endorsed. There's no word condemning slavery as against the dignity of mankind. In fact, there's nothing in the Quran about man being created in the image of God. The Muslim view is, say that we're created in the image of God, that's to insult God. We're no more in His image than an ant is in a human image. It's just a total no-no. But in the Quran, slavery is acknowledged as a given of God. And in four verses in the Quran, Muhammad authorizes Muslim men who may already have multiple wives to take their female slaves to their bed. Sex with female slaves is okay. Four verses. And here's a verse that says, do not compel your female slaves to be prostitutes to increase your wealth. So apparently saying, it's okay for you to have sex with them, but don't force a female slave to be a prostitute. That is going too far. But wait. There's another side of his personality that doesn't agree with what he just wrote. It's like, you know, two sides of his persona are at war. One wants to appear moralistic and the other couldn't care less about morality. And the latter one wins. Because after he makes that semi-moralistic statement, he doesn't put a period, he puts a comma, followed by this, if they care about chastity. So now what is he saying? Do not compel your female slaves to be prostitutes if they care about chastity. So that means if you have a female slave who doesn't care to be a chaste woman, you can use her as a prophet. Now please understand, I am not saying that Muslim men are quoting this verse as a justification for being brothel keepers. It's very likely, possible, that in the entire Islamic world, there's not a single Muslim man who quotes that verse as a justification to exploit women as prostitutes. I hope there isn't. I'm quoting it to let you know, because it's there, it shows the nature, the heart of Muhammad. If a Muslim man did want to use that as an excuse to be a brothel keeper, he could quote it. It's there. All right, but I haven't finished quoting it yet. It gets worse. After implying, just do a poll, and if you find female slaves who don't care about to be chaste, you can use them as prostitutes. No. He goes on to end the verse with this. But if you do compel them, Allah is forgiving and merciful. If you compel a female slave who desires to be chaste to be a prostitute against her will, Allah is forgiving and merciful. So it ends up with a complete permission to do it. If that was in the New Testament, would the whole world know about it? I think Christianity wouldn't exist. But it's in the Quran, and the world doesn't know about it. Muhammad's getting a free pass. Well, that's one of the most shocking things in the Quran. Now you know about it. And I'm not making this up. Go on google.com, 24 verse 33. But I do give this warning. Different English translations of the Quran number just a little bit, change the numbering of the verses a little. So often, if I'm looking for a reference and I find it, it doesn't say what I'm expected to. Look a few verses earlier or a few verses later and you'll find it. It's just, there's some variation there. And I do also want to express another word of warning. If you're going to buy a copy of the Quran or check it out online, beware, since 9/11, things have been changed. For example, in editions of the Quran printed before 9/11, you will find, for example, 5 verses in the Quran that say plainly, wage war in the cause of Allah until Islam is the only religion. That's there 5 times. In later editions, it's changed to strive hard. So that it can be interpreted as intellectual striving, social striving, not military force. No, 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 no. Others are fight hard. So there's some fudging going on. So beware of that. All right. Now let me tell you something that's in the Hadith, which is the second most sacred body of Muslim literature. In the Hadith, 2 Muslim men came to Muhammad for confession. And you and I think, oh, it's like Catholic parishioners going to the priest to confess their sins and be absolved. But this is different. They confessed to Muhammad, saying, and I quote, O Messenger of Allah, we kidnapped 2 women and we raped them. So you and I read that, we think, oh, they're sorry they kidnapped those 2 women. They regret raping them. At least that. But no, wait. That's not the point at all. They went on to explain the way they raped the 2 women. It wasn't the usual way. They practiced what is called in medical terms coitus interruptus because they didn't want to impregnate the 2 women. They just wanted to have pleasure with them but not make them pregnant. And after they did it that way, they thought, oh, we didn't even think. Maybe having sex with a woman that way is a total offense against Allah because it might prevent someone from existing that Allah intends should exist. And we're going to suffer in hell forever because of how we did it. So the whole point of the confession is not that they're sorry for raping 2 women. It was understood that was okay. Not sorry for kidnapping them. That everybody knew that was being done. Frequently it was par for the course. The only concern was it an offense against Allah to have sex that way. What should Muhammad have said to those 2 criminals? The Hadith shows he said to them, don't worry about that. Anyone Allah intends should exist will exist no matter what, so it's okay. That is in the Hadith. So, this is a basis for some very immoral behavior. I was invited to Saudi Arabia years ago by Christians who serve under Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company. And my visa said marriage counselor. So I would ask some couples, how's your marriage going? It's going fine. Good. Glad to hear it. But I was teaching Christians in what were called Oasis meetings. And you know, these meetings were being held in enclaves, walled enclaves set aside for foreigners, with a gate and guards at the gate, so nobody could go in or out without their knowing, keeping us separate from the Muslim, keeping the employees separate from the Muslim population. And so whenever there was a meeting, they wouldn't all park their cars close to the place where the meeting was, because the religious police, called mutawas, would be scouting around, and they saw a lot of automobiles parked close to one particular residence, they would burst in and search to see if there were any Bibles, anything going on, or if people had crosses hanging around their necks, and they would confiscate and destroy anything Christian without warning, just like that. So they'd park their cars all over the place and walk several blocks because of fear of the mutawa. Even there in an enclave devoted only to foreigners, they were on the march. If there were any inkling there might be liquor being served, they would be coming down. All right, so on my way flying into Dhahran on a flight, I was sitting next to a Britisher who worked under Aramco, and he'd been back to England for a vacation. Here he was coming back to resume his employment in Saudi Arabia, and he was gulping down rum and whiskey because he knew he wouldn't be able to have any more once the plane landed. And I said, how do you enjoy working in Saudi Arabia? He said, I hate this place. I hate this place. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And he said, if it wasn't for the high wages, no way would I work here. They got to pay me a fortune to work here. And I said, why are you so indignant? He said, well, several reasons. Let me tell you one. He said, I have a friend who was working here. He brought his wife to Saudi Arabia. He set out for a drive, and they turned into a little mini mall. And he left his wife in the car with the doors unlocked, went into a pharmacy to get something. There were three Muslim men standing there with their long white robes and black halos around the caps on their heads. And they saw the husband go into the pharmacy. Here was this foreign woman sitting there in the passenger seat in the front of the vehicle. So they walked around. One opened the door on the driver's side. The other two opened the back doors behind her. They all jumped into the car. One clapped his hand over her mouth to keep her from screaming. And the other one started the engine and drove off with her. The husband heard the vehicle, came running out and saw three white-robed Muslim men driving away in his car with his wife. They drove her out of the city, gang-raped her, killed her, and left her body lying by the side of the highway in the dark. Drove the car back into the city and abandoned it. He said, I hate this place, I hate this place. There was nothing in the newspapers about that, and I don't know, I don't think anyone was prosecuted. So I heard this from him. Then, here I am in one of those enclaves, and I'm talking with a man who was like a chaplain for the Christian employees, and I narrated for him what that Britisher had told me. And he said, Don, those three Muslim men will already have gone to a mullah and confessed what they did. And the mullah will have absolved them on the basis she was an infidel woman, not properly covered. If she'd been a Muslim woman, properly covered, as a decent woman would be, you would not have been tempted. She's responsible for what you did because she tempted you by not being properly covered. They're absolved. That links with things you find in the Quran and in the Hadith. So here's the problem. Let me sum up quickly. I mentioned the teachings of Wahhab that re-emphasize jihad are being more widely revived in mosques, especially in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and other places. The result of that is that militancy is increasing and is spreading. And the other thing that is giving strong incentive to the radical movement in Islam to gain momentum is this. Muslims see that the majority of the world's oil wealth is hidden where? Under the sands, predominantly of Muslim nations. Why is that? Oh, Allah foresaw that Islam was going to need a very large amount of wealth to sweep the world with the ultimate jihad and gain dominancy. And so he put the oil there because he knew we would need it. And so they take the provision of oil wealth as given by Allah to fund their ultimate sweep of the world with their view of what Islam is supposed to be like. Okay, here's the thing. The Saudis, whom Wahhab, back in the 1700s, it was Wahhab who enabled the Saudis to be the dominant family in what is now called Saudi Arabia. And so the Saudi royal family was enriching itself with the billions and billions of dollars of oil wealth by purchasing specially outfitted 747 jets for shopping trips to London and Paris and gambling trips to Monaco and Las Vegas, purchasing golf courses in Florida and racetracks in New York State. And the Wahhabis were watching this incredible hoard of wealth being squandered. And they began preaching against the Saudi royal family in the mosques throughout Saudi Arabia. And they've succeeded in turning the population against the royal family. And the royal families become aware that their lives are in danger, they're in jeopardy. But it turns out the Wahhabi clerics do not really want to have the royal family get their throats all slit in one night. They could order it and it would be done, because the population is on their side, not on the side of the Saudis. But instead, the Wahhabi clerics have come to the Saudis and said, "We need your cooperation. And if you grant us your cooperation, your lives will be spared. We need you to represent us politically in front of presidents and prime ministers and secretaries of state of the infidel nations. And if you'll agree to do that," because they wouldn't know how to talk to clerics like us, "but we need you, they know you. And if you will do that, we'll let you live. We'll even give you a very good living allowance. You're still going to be multimillionaires. You can reside in your resplendent palaces. Some Saudi families have four palaces, one for the spring, one for the summer, one for the fall, and one for the winter, all equally furnished. But the condition is you're going to turn over the vast majority of the oil wealth to us, and we're going to use it for Allah's purposes." So the Saudis have no choice. The most radical Muslims on the face of the earth, the Wahhabis, as they're called, have an enormous amount of oil wealth, and they're spending it according to their strategies, opening thousands and thousands of resplendent mosques in hundreds of cities they never showed any interest in before. Every city in South America and Central America has a mosque. The largest one is in Caracas, with Muslim schools right next to the mosque, with big signs saying in Spanish or in Portuguese, "Come see what Islam can do for you and your family." And they're opening tens of thousands of radical Muslim schools called madrasas, in which little Muslim boys beginning at 5, 6, 7 years of age are inducted with hatred of Christianity, hatred of Judaism, hatred of Christians and Jews, hatred of democracy. And this is happening. When young boys are infused with intense hatred that early in life, how easy will it be for them to be deprogrammed later? They're being bred like a plague of human locusts, millions of them, to come at the rest of the world willing to throw their lives away as suicide bombers if necessary. And while this is happening, something else that we're doing to ourselves is complicating it immensely. Have you all heard the expression birth dearth? You know the meaning of the word dearth? D-E-A-R-T-H. A lack, a scarcity. A scarcity of births. Demographers are beginning to warn all of Western civilization, including Japan, "You're doing yourselves in. For the population of a nation to remain constant, no increase, no loss, the average woman in that nation or in that ethnic group has to have 2.11 babies. That just is break even. The average woman in Spain is having 1.3 babies, but that includes hundreds of thousands of Muslim immigrant women in Spain who are having 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 children. If you subtract the Muslim childbearing component in Spain from the 1.3, the average non-immigrant Spanish woman is having 1.2 babies. That is demographic suicide. That is self-inflicted genocide. And the Muslim strategies, the Wahhabis see what we're doing to ourselves, and they're saying, Allah is ordaining this. He's blinding the infidels so they don't even have enough sense to have enough babies to sustain their population. But we're going to sustain ours. We're going to out-procreate them. Wahhabi is on television saying there are already 50 million Muslims in Western Europe, and they're going to take over. And we won't need to use bombs or bullets because we'll be able to outvote them. We can take advantage of democratic freedom. All the Muslim children being born there grow up with voting rights. So now it's quite apparent within probably 20 years, every nation of Western Europe may have a Muslim prime minister who will appoint a Muslim cabinet and Muslim generals in charge of the armed forces. It's not just Christians that are warning about this. Secular demographers are warning. So what is it that's keeping people from wanting to have babies? My mother was number 9 of 13. I was one of 6. 2 ended in miscarriages, so I was actually one of 4 that survived. And my wife, Carol Joy, and I had 5 pregnancies. 1 ended in miscarriage. We were prepared to raise 5 children. But now there are Christian couples who criticize other Christian couples for having 4 children. That should not be. What is the first command in the Bible, men and women? Be fruitful and multiply. Not just to prevent an Islamic takeover by sheer force of numbers, but just because it's a God-given right and blessing and obligation. Does God want the human race to exterminate itself through an elitist mentality that is just like in favoring extinction? I don't think so. And there are 4 things that we are doing to ourselves that are to our great detriment and ultimately to the advantage of what is going to be an overwhelming majority of Muslims living on our turf. Not that all the Muslims who come into Western civilizations are intent on... some of them are not aware of this at all. But the radicals can make them aware and say, join us because we're going to take over. You want to be on the winning side, don't you? So you know what you better do? Join with us. So the percentage of radicals is increasing every day at the expense of the percentages of moderates. It's happening. But the 4 things that are to the detriment of Western civilization are, first of all, extremely high abortion rates. Secondly, high divorce rates. Ever so many marriages are interrupted by divorce before enough children would be born to at least achieve the 2.11 level. Thirdly, millions of nice people who would never abort a pregnancy are practicing what demographically has to be considered excessive birth control. Fourthly, popularizing homosexuality as a valid lifestyle, even in elementary schools. Think of it. Homosexuality, by its very nature, is pro-extinction. This is a reason for not favoring it outside of Scripture. It is pro-extinction. If it progresses and gets more and more widespread, eventually it'll reach a critical mass, after which extinction is inevitable. So to favor it, to popularize it, is an insanity. Yes, there'll always be some homosexuals. Yes, okay, they'll be there, and they're protected by laws, okay. But all of this teaching about it, and every time some person in the movie industry comes out, oh, who knows how many teenagers are going to say, oh, I want to be like that too, when they otherwise wouldn't even think of it. So there's just, the liberal mind is just so lacking. You never hear a homosexual activist say, actually, we don't want to be too successful. Because we need straight people to have babies who grow up to be policemen to protect us from thugs. We need straight people to have babies who grow up to be doctors to treat us when we're sick. We need straight people to have babies that will be nurses and plumbers and electricians. They don't say that. It's as if they could go all out and sweep the world, the media, with their goals and get their goals established, and somehow mankind will still continue. It's an insanity. All right, so I could say so much more, but it's time for me. I already went over your culture calls for this message to end a few minutes ago. But I just want to say, I put so much more information in this book. I think with maybe 3 or 4 hours of reading here, you will end up with far more knowledge of the content of the Quran and the Hadith and the life of Muhammad and the history of Islam than the average Muslim has. Give yourself that advantage. Thank you. God bless you. We're going to have a break followed by a question and answer period.
Thank you. Thank you, Don.